Hello, I'm Helen Fospero. Welcome to the Convex Conversation, which this week puts Barnardo's CEO Javed Khan in the hot seat. Javed heads up more than 8,000 staff and 20,000 volunteers at Britain's leading children's charity. But I first met him in rather unusual circumstances. I'm a Barnardo's ambassador, and in a mad moment, I'd agreed to do my first ever abseil for them from the 114-metre-tall Olympic sculpture in London. My partner in crime that day was Javed, and together we psyched ourselves up to go over the edge and then marvelled at our bird's-eye view of London, dangling from a couple of what looked like fairly flimsy ropes. Javed, it's great to have you with us today. It was quite an exhilarating experience, wasn't it?
Delighted to be with you, Helen. Yeah, I'm not sure I could have done it without you. It was that exhilarating. We needed to give each other confidence, didn't we?
We certainly did. I'll never forget those sort of teetering steps over the edge as we could see the ground way, way, way below us. And I remember as we looked over the rooftops of the East End, you sharing the story of how and why Thomas Barnardo first started helping children back in the 1800s.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the origins of Barnardo's back in 1866 was literally a stone's throw away from the Olympic Village, where Thomas Barnardo first came across the extreme poverty that children were experiencing in Dickensian Britain, essentially sleeping in the gutters of the houses and on the rooftops. And he was actually on his way to China because he'd heard there was a lot of poverty in China and he wanted to do something about it, and then realized he didn't need to go any further, that the East End was as dire as it could get. And that was the beginning of the Barnardo's journey to now in 2020, the largest children's charity in the United Kingdom.
I mean, a lot of people, Javed, you know, are familiar with Barnardo's and think they know what you do. And I would put myself in that category when I first came to do some work with you. But actually, what you do is extraordinary. There are so many projects and services that you run. Can you give us sort of a potted sense of what circumstances you're helping families, youngsters and children?
So at a headline level, what Barnardo's does is what it's always done, which is pretty straightforward. And that is, we exist to support vulnerable children and young people in society and whatever their vulnerabilities are. And over the decades of the last 154 years, that's morphed into different ways and means because the society has changed and legislation has changed. And so once upon a time, Barnardo's ran hundreds of orphanages up and down the country where hundreds of thousands of children who didn't have a family to look after them were being supported through to their early adult life. And now, of course, all orphanages are not needed any longer because of fostering and adoption, and so different systems are in place. But the modern-day Barnardo's, we support about 300,000 vulnerable children and young people, their families, their carers, every year across all four nations of the United Kingdom. And we do that through over 1,000 different programs. So in most community settings, in most parts of the country, Barnardo's will be there. We support children and young people from the ages of 0 to 25. We actually do work with parents before their children are born as well. But the underlying theme always is vulnerability. And that vulnerability can manifest itself in many, many ways. As I say, fostering and adoption. We're actually the largest voluntary sector agency that provides that support to thousands of children every year. But we support children who have mental health issues, a whole range of mental health issues, from starting with anxiety through to autism, through to very severe challenges. We support children who have been abused within the home. We support children who have been sexually abused and exploited. We work with trafficked children. We work with children at risk of female genital mutilation. We run services up and down the country with families, trying to hold families together, parenting classes. We work in schools. We work in communities. We work in partnership with local councils up and down the country. We run projects for the government. We bring all of that experience, and it is as broad as it can get, that knowledge and that understanding of what's going on the streets of Britain, and package it together and then take these messages to government as well. Because Barnardo's has the great privilege of, you know, people listen when we speak. And so we're speaking to ministers all the time in and out of Downing Street, trying to influence legislation at the highest level so that tomorrow's children benefit from a more compassionate society.
When you come from a loving family and you give your children a safe and secure home, the true picture of what life's like for some children in the UK isn't always apparent. I mean, do you have any facts or figures or stories, Javed, to illustrate what's going on below the surface, if you like?
Well, you know, it's a great discussion point. I travel around the world often for all kinds of reasons, and the people often say to me, well, why is Barnardo's needed in Great Britain? You know, you're the sixth largest economy in the world. Surely there isn't the level of vulnerability in Britain that you're talking about. And then I tell them what it's like. You don't need to scratch very deep beneath the surface of this great country of ours to find the 4.5 million plus children who are living in abject poverty in this country. And that's not because their parents are lazy or not working. You know, 62% of those families, the parents are in work, but are underemployed. And these are pre-COVID statistics. I'll come on to the COVID impact in a moment. One in four 14-year-old girls is exhibiting social anxiety at the moment. Whole host of reasons for why that may be the case. The mental health support systems in this country, pre-COVID, I described as being in crisis. And it's got worse. There just isn't the support available for those who need it when they need it. And then the problems get stored up and it becomes much more difficult for us to support those young people when they get older. All kinds of issues around children in care and those leaving care. You know, these are some of the most challenged children for a whole range of reasons, because they don't have the magic of a loving family often to look after them. And so they are in care, and we do our best as a society to provide fostering placements for them. But all the statistics show that the child who's in care has the least chance of being successful in their GCSE examinations. Forget about anything after that. So they come out of the education world with virtually no qualifications, no job prospects. And Barnardo's tries its best to provide employment training and skills opportunities, giving them hopefully a sustainable future in the employment world. But the challenges in our country are great. And it is so easy to forget those, thinking that, well, you know, we're a prosperous country and we're a highly developed country. Yes, we are. But actually, there is a undercurrent of serious challenge. And unfortunately, that has got much worse in the 12 weeks of lockdown.
We'll talk about COVID in a moment, Javed. I know that young people's mental health is a key priority for Barnardo's. Let's just have a listen to your recent Believe in Me advert.
I moved school when I was 10. I don't know why they picked me. I was always scared and worried. Even at home, they'd message me all the time. I just wanted to hide. But coming to Barnardo's helped me deal with it. I feel better. Stronger. I know I can get past this.
The sounds we heard there are hyenas in the advert. How do strong advertising campaigns help to get the message across to people who perhaps are unaware of the problems that we face in Britain?
Well, advertising and brand marketing, as it were, is very, very powerful, and particularly through the medium of television, because it still remains the kind of mass audience messaging. And that advert particularly was very challenging. We'd spent a lot of time researching about what the right thing to do was, and involved young people as well. Listen to their articulation of what it feels like to have a mental health issue and high social anxiety that could result from bullying, as was the case in that advert. And they described the feeling of that pressure that they're under at that moment, at their most darkest moment, as if everyone around them is challenging them, giving them greater concerns. And they articulated it as animals are chasing them in a pack. And that's where the hyena analogy came from. It was highly controversial, but we really wanted to punch home hard to all of the viewing public to try and understand what it's like to walk in the shoes of young children who are suffering mental health issues.
And of course, the impact of the pandemic on vulnerable children and families in Britain, I would imagine, has been absolutely enormous, has it?
It's been an absolute shock to see the spike in demand. And my fear is that we are, even though we're seeing the spike now, this is nothing compared to what we're going to see when we come out the other end. So when, for example, when schools go back fully in September and all of the children are back in school, I think we're going to see an outpouring of all of the challenges that those children are storing up now. Because, you know, I mean, in lockdown, you and I and others, you know, where we've got children and we try and provide the best support for them as we can, and they may have a garden and open space to try and get some respite. But many of the children that we're talking about here today in the Bernardo support, you know, they don't have those luxuries. They don't have that supporting family. They are in isolation themselves, so their usual support networks of their friends and often their teachers who provide that respite has been taken away from them. They don't have the garden and the open space to get some respite from being locked indoors all the time. The incidents of domestic abuse have shot up as well. You know, that's well documented now amongst the police reports, not just here, in all countries. It's one of the implications of lockdown. Now, all those issues are being stored up and they will flood out when the children come back into the system, as it were. And my fear is that the support systems, the mental health support services, will move from crisis phase to catastrophe. There just won't be enough resource. And then charities like Bernardo's will be relied upon much more than ever before.
And in a way, I'm imagining there's a perfect storm because of the virus, I presume your funds have been decimated, have they?
From the first day of lockdown, you know, we had to close all of our retail stores, our 710 stores, which were generating about £8 million a month, which we were ploughing back into our children's services. So that disappeared straight away. All of our public fundraising stopped. So our events, our galas, our dinners, you know, our abseils, all of that had to stop. And that's made a massive dent on our income. And as a result, a dent in the money that we can spend on children's services. Now, we've launched an emergency crisis appeal, and the great British public has always been a great supporter of Bernardo's, and people have done their best. But it is, the income that we've got from that does not compare to what we have lost because of the lockdown. And so, the perfect storm is coming. As you say, the most vulnerable will be in the greatest need more than they've ever been before. They will turn to the state, often local government, for those support services. The state will be trying to grapple with the deepest global recession that any of us will have seen in our lifetime. So they won't have those resources. They'll turn to the charity sector. Charities will rely on donors having the confidence to donate to us. And with the job market as it's going to suffer in the months and years ahead, that is going to be difficult for donors as well. So we won't have the resources to meet that demand, and the cycle begins again. So it is my greatest fear, and I say this with great consideration, I've never been so worried in all the years that I've been a chief executive of Bernardo's.
I read an article that you wrote in the last week or two, and I think you said there that COVID's highlighted deep-rooted inequalities we've papered over for decades.
Absolutely. At some point, I think some politician said that COVID-19 was a great leveller in society. I completely disagree. It isn't a leveller, actually. The most vulnerable have been affected the most in a whole range of ways. If you dig even deeper and look at the disproportionate impact on Black and Asian minority ethnic families in terms of more susceptible to catching COVID, less chance of surviving it, and therefore much more risk of BAME young people having suffered bereavement and unsupported bereavement, where they haven't had the counselling or the therapy that would have been available to them normally. And that will have an impact on them for a very long time. We're at risk of losing a whole generation of young people because sticky plaster solutions, the ones that are being offered at the moment to them, just won't wash.
How can we help, Javed?
I think, there are people out there that really care about these issues. And that's what's so great about working in the charity sector for me in this great country of Great Britain. There are a lot of people that care. We've got to raise the awareness of the plight of the most vulnerable at the moment. And there are some very generous people out there who have got the resources and have done very well themselves. And my plea to them is, this is the time for you to stand up and support these great causes. Because if you don't, and the government doesn't manage to do it either because he's got lots of other things to worry about, then we will lose these millions of children in the meantime. And in years to come, they will turn into adults who will have great, great personal challenges, and society will have to pay for it anyway. So my plea is, spread the message of how challenging this time is. And if we don't act now, we will rue the day.
And Javed, growing up, you said that your family would have struggled with this.
My parents, my father passed away about 30 years, God bless his soul, and my mother is still with us, emigrated from Kashmir in South Asia in the late 50s. And I was born in 1963. And neither of my parents had been touched by the magic wand of education throughout their lives. They couldn't read or write in any language. So they had a very simple existence. My father was a laborer on the shop floor of a car manufacturing plant, and my mother was a homemaker. So we didn't have any material possessions. You know, we had no interaction between family, our home life, and our educational experience through inner city Birmingham is where I grew up, through inner city schools, comprehensive schools, and so on, which when I look back, I'm very proud of that time, actually, because it taught me a great deal about the importance of the basic necessities in life, basic education, because we were not only the representatives of our parents at institutional level, you know, whether it's the GPs or the dentist or at school, but we were writing for them, we were translating for them because they couldn't speak the language. But what we did have was a really deep and consistent love in our family and a very hard work ethic. There was nothing else they could provide. But when I look back and I think now about the work that I do at Barnardo's, you know, a journalist once asked me, hearing that story, and said, do you think you should have been a Barnardo's boy? And I actually hadn't thought about it that way. And I gave it due consideration and said, actually, no, I shouldn't have been, because I had the one ingredient in my childhood that so many children that we support at Barnardo's don't have. And that is unconditional love. It wasn't about material possessions. It wasn't about the support that we needed at school, but it was the deep-seated love at home through not just my immediate family, but my extended family. You know, in those days, the whole family got involved in helping bring up a child, and that made an enormous difference to me. And too many families these days, too many children, unfortunately, don't have that love, care, and attention. And Barnardo's tries to put that back in their lives.
It must have been very difficult for mum and dad to leave their homeland. Did they talk to you a bit about that growing up?
They really did. And it was an economic migration. My father did 14 years in the British Indian Army in the Second World War, actually as a foot soldier. So he was one of the early people to be offered a chance to come to the motherland, as it were, you know, the old British Empire head office. And so came here, but came and did some of the toughest and the worst and the, pardon my language, the shittiest jobs that were around. You know, it was like sweeping floors. But he did it because he wanted to create a better opportunity for his family, and worked really, really hard throughout his life and paid his taxes and was an honest, decent citizen. But if COVID had happened at that time, there's no doubt in my mind he would have lost his job and he would have had no savings to fall back on, and we would have suffered extreme poverty as a family.
And they must have been very proud of you, Javed, because you went on to teach maths, didn't you, in the Midlands after school?
Yeah, so I struggled my way through education, to put it bluntly. You know, I failed more than I passed. You know, they say you never forget a great teacher. There was one brilliant maths teacher in our inner city comprehensive, which for some unknown reason to me, took me under his wing from about the age of 14 through to 18 and caught me before I fell every time. He used to give me extra tuition at lunchtime and after school and help me understand the things that I couldn't understand. And by hook or by crook, got me through my A-levels. And then because of his inspiration, I went on and did a maths degree, would you believe, which I never could have imagined. It was the only subject I was any good at. Because of him, went on and did teacher training and decided to teach math, which was the very best decision that I could have made, because I absolutely adore that profession. And I even say now to my, you know, teaching friends that the day I retire from what I'm doing, which I've got no plans to do yet, but I want to go back and teach for free to anybody that will have me, because I still think I can make a contribution.
So how does a maths teacher go from the classroom to what you're doing now?
Well, you know, I feel I've been hugely, hugely blessed in a number of ways. I had some great people that I've worked with, great mentors along the way who I've looked up to and have given me great advice. And I think, you know, when I look back, I think my father, as an uneducated man, to leave what was Greater India and then Pakistan and Kashmir and come to these shores, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 miles away without a penny in his pocket, couldn't speak the language, but he had the pioneering spirit in him. He was a risk taker, and he took much greater risks than anything that I have ever done because of his circumstances. And I think that's in my DNA. So I took a number of risks in my career, moving around, not staying in one place every few years, you know, and trying to, and had this hunger and desire to do more. And throughout that, feeling hugely privileged, just the fact that I had a job because of my own personal upbringing, you know, very simple origins, as I said, and to have a professional working job, which opened huge doors for you. You know, you had money in your pocket. Others were prepared to lend you money and so on and so on. That was a privilege for me. I never took it for granted. So I worked really, really hard, and harder than perhaps many other people might have done in my shoes. And I got rewarded for that because I was always volunteering to do more over and above what I was paid to do. So as a teacher, you know, I was volunteering to run sports clubs. I was volunteering to run, you know, XYZ additional extracurricular activities for the young people and for at a professional level as well. I was volunteering within my community. I was quite a community activist at the local level, never stood for elected office, but worked with lots of people who did and helped them get elected. So I always had this desire to do more and then took risks. And the biggest risk was to leave the frontline teaching profession and joined Birmingham City Council as an assistant director of education, where I was catapulted into the limelight. You know, Birmingham City Council, largest council in Europe. I suddenly had 3,000 people working for me, a £50 million budget, and had to try and make something of that. And Birmingham is a tough place. Birmingham City Council is a tough place to work. So I learned a great deal about operating at a political level with politicians, not being political, but working with politicians and trying to make a difference on a large scale. And then completely unexpectedly got appointed to the director of education role in a London borough, which at the time for me was the pinnacle of my career. Being an educationalist, I never thought it could get any better than that. And I did that for about 7 years and really, really thoroughly enjoyed it. And then an opportunity came along to be seconded to the government office for London in the days that that existed. This was about 10 years ago. And the chance to work pan-London on the very serious issue of serious youth violence and headed up a pan-London board. And this was the last time there was a spike. This is back in 2009-10 in serious youth violence incidents, young people murdering other young people. And I did that for about two and a half years. And it was a great eye-opener in terms of the challenges that young people face. And one of the great pieces of learning was that, you know, at one point we did a detailed case study of 17 incidents of youth homicides where young teenagers had killed other young teenagers. And we looked at the life histories of the murdered and the murderer. And actually the most astounding findings were that their case histories were almost identical in every way. Virtually no differentiation between the murderer and the murdered. And it really made me think about who is the victim in society when you look at it that way. So these young people had lived in really troubled families, experienced early life trauma through domestic abuse and serious violence. They'd been in and out of school, been in and out of pupil referral units, or been excluded from schools. They'd personally experienced early life violence, where the local gang in the place that they lived had victimized them, and they'd gone to hospital and been patched up and got the stitches and came out. And the very people who'd inflicted the violence on them were the ones that were waiting for them at the hospital gate, welcoming them and saying, right, that's what happens to you if you're not part of our gang. You now have a choice. Do you want to see more of that, or do you want to be part of us? And these kids had no choice but to enter what turned into a life of serious crime and ended up either killing or being killed. And it really, really shook me and made me think about, you know, what is it we're doing in society and what is it that we're not doing to try and intervene to stop that from happening? And, you know, additionally, every person we spoke to who'd been in touch with those young people, say the school head teacher in the primary school or the secondary school, the local police sergeant that has come into contact with them, every one of them said, yeah, we could have predicted this. We could have predicted he was going to kill somebody. We could have predicted he was going to get killed. But the system did not intervene to stop it from happening. And that drove an enormous kind of commitment on my part about, you know, what I wanted to do to tackle disadvantage, to tackle injustice, social injustice, criminal injustice. And that took me to the opportunity of being chief executive of Victim Support, which was, again, completely unplanned. I expected to go back to local government, but had 3.5 years, wonderful years of leading a brilliant charity. It covered England and Wales. And I could have stayed there through to retirement. That's how much I was enjoying it. And then the Barnardo's bus came knocking on the door, and it was completely irresistible. It gave me the chance to go back to children and young people issues, which, as I say, is where I grew up professionally. And it gave me the chance to work on the largest scale in the UK. It doesn't get any bigger and more complex than Barnardo's. And the opportunity to work with hundreds of thousands of young lives and take that message to parliamentarians and change society. You know, we often use that kind of phrase, it's overused, that we want to make a difference, we want to change the world. Well, in Barnardo's, you literally can do that because of the size and scale.
That's funny you should say making a difference. I was just about to say I'm trying to work out, or was going to ask you, what drives you. But is it that in these positions you can make a difference and that you can make a big difference, Javed?
Yeah, completely. Modesty aside, I mean, I'm hugely privileged to be the chief executive of this fantastic charity. But with it comes great responsibility as well, of balancing out the huge satisfaction that you get from knowing that your small contribution is making a big difference to the individual lives and the collective development of society and how we bring compassion to communities, but also being able to package that and take it to ministers when ministers, you know, will listen because you represent Barnardo's and your brand and your history and your reputation. And you're going to do it in a very considered way. You know, we don't do shrill. We don't lock ourselves to the bars outside Westminster and, you know, make a fuss like that. We take sophisticated arguments to government and get them to reconsider their policies and improve the legislation. And that really does make a difference. You know, on our 150th anniversary, I was invited to do a lecture at my old alma mater, my university, on any topic I chose. And I chose the 150 years of Barnardo's. And I did a lot of research and I discovered that there are 12 specific instances in those 150 years where Barnardo's did exactly what I'm talking about. Spotted a need on the streets of Britain, got the resources to do something about it, ran the services, captured the evidence and the research of what it taught us, took that to government, and then helped government develop a change to legislation that improved a lot of the vulnerable children in this country. 12 specific instances. Now, that's something I'm hugely proud of in terms of the legacy of Barnardo's in Britain, and my job is to do more of that.
Your teams on the front line deal with heartbreaking, challenging, difficult stories every day. How do you keep your heart out of the decision-making process and protect yourself from, you know, as a father, being swept away in the emotion and the frustration of seeing young people in such difficult and worrying situations?
Well, you know, Helen, it's not easy. Every time, and I regularly go out and visit our services, you know, to get that adrenaline boost and that reminder of what I need to do in the offices and in the boardrooms to connect with the front end. And I see that magic happening all the time. But it does give me a jolt every time I see it, when I see the plight of those children and their families. And when I come back home, and I'm a father of four, and my children are not school age anymore, you know, they're older, but they've seen me do this work for a number of years. And they know every time that I've been out to see the front end, because I come back home and I sit very quietly and I sit and I reflect and I contemplate what I've got in my family, however we've got it, the support that my children have got, and what I've just witnessed over the last day or two and the place that I visited. And they know, they can tell from my eyes what I'm going through. And then they encourage me to talk to them about it so they can learn. And actually, for us as a family, Barnardo's is a part of the family. So my family, you know, regularly raise funds and volunteer into our services. And, you know, it is a collective endeavor for us. People say I work very hard. I don't think I do, because to me, honestly, it doesn't feel like work. It's a cause that we are all connected to. And that's what drives me.
We mentioned in the introduction, Javed, the huge team that you lead. I think it was 8,000 staff members. And of course, there are 20,000 volunteers manning your shops around Britain. How difficult is it and challenging to manage such a big team, just being the one of you?
So, you know, I have some fantastic people working for me, of course. So, you know, my part is minuscule, really.
Very humble.
Well, I take the blame for when things go wrong, but the credit goes to everybody else when we get it right. And we do get it right more often than not. So some brilliant, brilliant people. But, you know, my heart goes out to the people working on the front line of Barnardo's. Even in the COVID crisis, 500 to 600 of our staff have been working face to face throughout all of this, putting their own lives at risk. You know, we provided them with protective equipment wherever we could get hold of it, but they did not let our services stop running, because those children would have had nowhere else to go. They wouldn't have had anywhere else to sleep that night. And those services go out, you know, so they deserve the credit. And then many other thousands of people have been working remotely, staying in touch with children, trying to provide whatever we can. And then our volunteers really are the salt of the earth. You know, we recently did a calculation of, if we just paid them a nominal £10 an hour for the support, they're worth much, much more than that. That would amount to between £25 and £30 million of support that we get from our volunteers. We could not operate as a charity without them. So they are the real stars of what Barnardo's does. You know, they really are the salt of the earth. And I see the impact that they have day in, day out. So my heart goes out to them, really. You know, I'm a bit player in that. But leading a charity like Barnardo's, you've got to understand that it is big and it is complex, and you need flexibility in your leadership style to make it successful. You know, people often describe big organizations as an oil tanker that doesn't turn overnight. Well, Barnardo's I describe as a flotilla of oil tankers, because, you know, each element of it is so large and complex that you've got to treat them differently, and you've got to have some consistent messaging about what we stand for, our values and our principles, which we don't budge from. But within that, freedom for the local services to flex. So our retail chain, for example, 710 shops, is a business on the high street and has got to be given that freedom and flexibility. But then we have our frontline children's services, we have our back office support functions, and each of these has to be treated slightly differently. But they all come together for one purpose, and that is to support vulnerable children in Britain.
You deflect really beautifully, Javed, and I know that you do see yourself very much as a bit part. But as CEO, how would you describe your leadership style?
I think, you know, right at the top of the list, I think for anybody who does a job like this, is your authenticity. If you're not authentic, if you don't really believe in the cause that you are leading, then you will get found out, and this job is not for you. So authenticity matters most. And in a place like Barnardo's, if you haven't got it, you can be spotted a mile away. And so that really matters. And I believe I've got that. And I try to display that in every which way. Alongside that, a high degree of passion alongside compassion for what we do, but being authentic all the way.
And of course, Black Lives Matter is very much on our minds at the moment after George Floyd's murder. What troubles you, Javed, about the race situation?
Yeah, I'm in a very sad and tragic way. The George Floyd affair, you know, our heart goes out to George's family and his killing. But there is a silver lining in this tragedy that I believe that worldwide, and particularly in the UK, we are now talking in a very confident way about issues that we've needed to talk about for a very long time. So I remember growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, where race was an issue then. In the 80s, you know, there were some very high profile cases around the experience of black people in this country. There was race awareness training was going on in the professions and so on. And the net result of all that is not much has changed. Now, I say that with due consideration because I believe, like many people have said, that Great Britain is one of the best places to live as a black, as a BAME person in the whole of Western Europe. I say that having traveled around all those countries, this is where I would rather be than anywhere else. Having said that, though, we can't turn a blind eye to the challenges that we've got in society. I believe post-Stephen Lawrence, you know, most of our institutions, if not all, do have institutional racism within them. And Barnardo's is no exception. And I've been very honest and straight talking with our staff and saying we've got questions to ask ourselves as well. But let's do it in a spirit of confidence on the back of the Black Lives Matters movement. What more can we do to help our BAME colleagues? And I speak as a BAME CEO, one of the very few BAME CEOs of the large children's charities in the United Kingdom. That in itself is a problem, I think. But we've got to speak with great confidence about what the issue is, call it out for what it is. If there is institutional prejudices in our organizations, and we must assume that there are until we can prove that there aren't, then we must have no ifs, no excuses, no buts. We've got to tackle it. And I believe we're at a pinnacle moment in our history that we can now do this, because more and more colleagues are speaking up in a way that perhaps they didn't have the confidence to do before. And we need to listen and we need to act.
Presumably growing up in inner city Birmingham in the 70s, you experienced racism, Javed.
Yeah, all the time. So, you know, from what used to be overt racism, so the old days of the skinheads chasing you down the street, it's happened to me, been attacked, been hurt individually and collectively, name calling, you know, being called a paki, you know, you black bastard, get out of this country, all that kind of stuff. I was even called a paki in a police station, once would you believe, when I was there trying to represent a student of mine when I used to work in further education colleges. This is back in the 80s. So, you know, I've seen it, but I'm less worried about the overt race and prejudice that you see, because you know what it is. You know who you're talking to. Much more sinister is the covert practice of prejudice. And that's where institutional racism, structural racism comes in. And I've seen that as well. I've felt it. It's much, much harder for people like me and others to talk about, because you can't always prove it. You know, it's a look, it's a phrase, it's being accepted or not accepted, being invited to a meeting and not invited for no good reason. These are difficult things to challenge in organizations. And since George Floyd, you know, colleagues have been writing to me and talking about these experiences that they're having in a way that they didn't feel confident enough to do before. And it's brought back those kind of memories to me. And on another level, I mean, if I just give you some other examples, I used to play cricket a lot in my youth until my knees gave way for about 25 years at club cricket level. And I now reflect on many of those teams that I played with were almost all white. That wasn't a problem. You know, I had great friends, great relationships, and I was a pretty good player as well. But my name is Javed, and very rarely by those white colleagues was I ever referred to as Javed. I was called Jack, I was called Jake, I was called Jez. And at the time, I didn't object. You know, it wasn't an issue for me. I'm looking back now and saying, I should have said, hang on a minute, my name is Javed, call me Javed. Don't try and make me conform to a white Eurocentric image that you feel comfortable with, and therefore I fit in. Otherwise, I don't. And so, you know, how does one tackle that? Those are examples of how prejudice can manifest itself by people who are otherwise perfectly decent, good human beings, but they don't realize they're doing it themselves. Why is it that in the police force, when you speak to a BAME police officer, and I know lots of them, if his name is Mohammed, he's always referred to as Mo, but never Mohammed. If his name is Satvinder, he will have been called Steve. If his name is Maktoum, he will have been referred to as Mike. This is rampant across the police service. Why is that? I don't think these are coincidental approaches from the institutions. I think there is deep-seated prejudice and a pressure on people who are different to conform to the norm. And that is some of what we have to tackle. And I think is at the root cause of this whole agenda of Black Lives Matter. And I really welcome it.
From having met you, Javed, a number of times and seen you speak and listening to your voice today, I mean, it really is clear that Bernardo's really is very much part of your family and you live and breathe your work and you don't really see it as work. But what do you do to switch off and to relax? Obviously not cricket, because your knees don't sound like they're up to that anymore. But how do you switch off?
I feel I'm a very balanced kind of person in terms of home and work life. And part of that balance is because the Bernardo's cause means so much to me and my family that the lines are blurred between work and home life. And we're blurred in a very healthy way. To that, I would add that two other things. I'm a father. And, you know, as parents, all parents know, your children have no respect for your professional standing. So you're not their chief executive, right? You're just dad. And they remind you of it and they bring you back to life very quickly, back down to earth, you know, in case you get carried away with all the pomp and ceremony of the authority that you might have. So that's a great leveler in itself. And add to that, my own mother, bless her, who's in her 70s now. And to this day, as I say, can't read or write, speaks broken English. And I sit with her regularly and I still read her doctor's letters for her and help her out in all kinds of ways. And that also is a great reminder to me and a balancer of actually, I've been blessed enormously in my career and this opportunity that I've got. But actually, I keep my feet firmly on the ground and she helps me do that. She's very proud of what I've achieved, but she doesn't really understand it. She likes seeing me on television every now and again, but can't understand what I'm talking about. But she's very proud of it. And so, you know, that's a great reminder to me. And then the final thing is, I'm also quite a spiritual person in a whole range of ways. And that spirituality has taught me that my only job in life is to give 110% to the opportunities I've been given today and not worry at all about tomorrow, because it's not in my control. There is a greater being that controls my destiny. It's not for me to determine that. So why worry about tomorrow? Just focus on today and do your level best to get the best out of yourself.
I love the fact that Mum feels so proud of seeing you on the television. And hopefully she'll enjoy our podcast with you. Javed, I knew you'd be a fantastic guest. And thank you for explaining how we can all help with those worst affected, not just by the pandemic, but, you know, giving us a real sense of what children and young people are facing. Sometimes in our world, we don't really see what's really, really going on. So it's been really lovely to chat to you today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Helen. And anybody wants to support Bernardo's, bernardos.org.uk, please get in touch.
Well, you've been listening to Javed Khan, CEO of Bernardo's, Britain's leading children's charity, which helps disadvantaged children, youngsters and families. Join me next week for another inspirational guest. And don't forget to share the Convex conversation with your friends and family. We're at convex.podbean.com or on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts. Bye for now. See you soon.